This morning I'm going to talk about something that many of you maybe have wondered about. You see it all the time, and it's something we don't talk about at all, and that's ritual. And when you come into a Zen center, you see people bow, you hear chants, you know, it's all kind of unusual. So I thought, well, you know, let's talk about that. And what my plan is to give a short definition of ritual, give a number of reasons why we in the West tend to be resistant to ritual, and then to give some examples of actual ritual that we do in our various practices, etc. And then end with the discussion of how we can carry some of that ritual outside of the Zendo in our daily practices, which is where we really want it to go. And at least that's the plan. And so we'll see how it goes. And I may not get to everything, but we'll do what we can do. What is ritual? We don't want to be too rigid when we try to define a concept by ritual, but it has a number of aspects we should be aware of. And one is it's an action. It's not something cognitive or something in the mind. It's something we do. It's an action. It's a repetitive action, if you will. The intent basically is to get something by doing ritual that we usually can't get in other ways. And also it's something that we usually do together. It's a communal kind of practice, and it's usually based on tradition. And so we can actually trace some of our Zen rituals back for some time. Just some of the aspects of ritual, because we want to pay attention to these. It's repetitive. Remember, it's an action. It's not something cognitive, etc. We're trying to get something. We might want to ask what all of that's about. It's something we do communally, etc. Well, in the West, we tend to be pretty resistant to ritual. And I know people who say, hell no, I won't bow. I know they're really resistant to various kinds of ritual. And I think if we're going to understand the role of ritual in Zen Buddhism, we have to have some idea about why we might feel some resistance. And I'm going to give three examples from Asia and two from the West. And we could give more, but I think that'll be sufficient. If we read a lot of Zen literature and we read about a classic Zen in China, Chan, etc., and we read about all kinds of iconoclastic characters, you know, characters who don't live by tradition. They usually live in the woods, if you will, that they don't read the text. There's a transmission outside of the literature. Things like this. And so we get an idea that these are very unusual individuals. That's how we should pattern our life, if you will. The problem with that view, as much as we read it all the time, is that it's about 98% mythic. It's basically myth. Some of the great stories, they talk about Matsu, who was the first of the four great golden age Zen masters. And they talk about living in a rural area, have nothing to do with politicians, things like this. And if you actually look at what he does, and there are excellent studies now, he actually lived in a big urban area. He had two great values. One is he was a truly great Zen master, and he attracted the very best students from Korea and China. And he had 60 to 70 students who actually went out throughout urban centers in China and all became very famous. Now, secondly, he was a great politician. Instead of not interacting with politicians, he was sought by politicians, and he actually had a big state-run monastery in an urban area. His most famous student, Pai Chang, if you take courses, they talk. Pai Chang is the one who supposedly said, "No work, no food." And I mean, it sounds really great. And supposedly it sets him apart from other kind of Buddhists, but of course that's a myth as well. and we can go on and on. We think of the sixth patriarch, Hui Nen, for example, who apparently was supposedly kind of a... are you here for the class or the talk? Hui Nen, for example, was supposedly a farmer who heard a sutra and suddenly became enlightened, etc. His platform sutra actually took 200 years to write after his death. And these days you can study all this in great, great detail. And I could go on and on about Bodhidharma and his fabrication. There's no way Bodhidharma ever met Emperor Wu and things like this. And one of our first reactions might be, if there's so much historical falsehoods, then what should we make of that literature? Now, one of the great scholars of the Chang Buddhism, a guy called John McRae, he's kind of a character. He's got McRae's rules of studying Zen, I'll give you three examples. The first is that the more untrue it is, the more valuable it is. His point is that there are great teachings here, that have been produced by hundreds of different monks. So don't get hung up in historical reality. What are the teachings? Okay. A second McRae rule is the lineage system is a fabrication. Therefore, it's even more valuable. What he's doing is he's looking at the lessons. If you've taken Zen courses, when they talk about transmission outside the text, they say it usually starts with Mahakasyapa. The Buddha was giving a talk, had a flower in his hand, and kind of tweaked it and winked at Mahakasyapa, who suddenly became enlightened. And this is the first example of a transmission outside the text. But of course, that story doesn't appear until 1,300 years after the death of the Buddha. Okay? My point as far as understanding ritual is there's a Grand Canyon gap, if you will, between what's said, what they said Zen is about, and its actual practice, which is truly rooted in ritual in these large monasteries. And so we want to kind of understand that. And it's all a fascinating story. Now, the second Asian example of where our understanding of Zen Buddhism becomes distorted is during the Meiji period in Japan, which really starts in the late 19th century. It starts in 1868. And the Western colonial powers is just beating on the door of Japan, trying to get them to open to trade and exploitation, if you will. And, of course, the Japanese resist, and they resist by becoming extremely nationalistic. Part of becoming nationalistic is to get rid of anything foreign. And, of course, Zen Buddhism, like all Buddhism, comes from China. It's foreign. So they eradicate, and this is the word that you usually see, they eradicate about 80% of the Zen community. Come on in, don't be shy. So they eradicate about 80% of the Japanese Buddhist temples. And what the Buddhists respond by reinventing themselves. We're not foreign, but rather we have a teaching that's outside the teaching. In fact, you can't describe it in words. It's right in here. You feel it. You understand it. Furthermore, it's rational. It's psychological. It's about the mind, if you will. It's iconoclastic in the sense that you deny tradition. Well, all of this, of course, the West really wanted to hear. But it's not what was going on in Buddhism at the time. But it was this view of Buddhism as rational, psychological, iconoclastic. Iconoclastic just means out of the norm. You're not part of the main traditions, etc. It's this kind of Buddhism that D.T. Suzuki brings to the United States in the early 1900s. And if you're a person of my age, you grow up reading D.T. Suzuki. And he's presenting this image of Buddhism, of Zen as, you know, rational, etc., and all these wonderful things. And Ellen Watts, all of the people I love. And imagine the surprise of the first Westerners who go to Japan to really learn that kind of Zen. And what do they find? They find these big state-run monasteries where everybody does ritual. And they're worried about death rituals, birth rituals. They actually are involved in magic, believe it or not. Today you can go to a Thai Buddhist temple and you can get a nice tattoo that's going to protect you from all kinds of bad things. You know what I mean? So we have, again, in the Meiji period, we have a big gulf, a big gap between what Zen is claimed to be and what actually goes on. And then the third Asian practice that makes us perhaps not interested in ritual is the fact that their teaching practice is to never tell you what's going on. And so you can spend 15 or 20 years in a Zen center, you can do all the bowing, and nobody ever says, this is why we're doing it. And that tradition carries over here. So you can come and you say, well, I want to come to a morning practice period. And you can come for 5 years, and they'll tell you the form. They'll say, you bow, etc. But nobody tells you what's it about. Okay? In Asia, if you're interested in martial arts, you go to a martial arts master, and you study with the master for many years, and the master finally comes and says, okay, you can leave. It's time. So what happens when Westerners, and we want to know why things happen and where we are along the road, etc. And so when Westerners start practicing martial arts, they have to introduce grades. And so suddenly you have white belts, yellow belts, brown belts, all kinds of black belts, purple belts, etc. And so you get that kind of idea. So there's a great tradition of not telling of people what's going on. And it makes sense if you grow up and you go into a monastery at 12 and you learn the rituals, etc., and you learn how to practice them. But we are lay people in the West, and so we need a somewhat different understanding. So let's move to the West and see why in the West we have some resistance to ritual. I'll just mention two. The first has to do with the Enlightenment. I remember the emergence of science and resistance against religion. And this starts in, you're going from 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century. And the rallying cry of the Enlightenment is no more myth, no more magic. Okay? And what they're learning in the Enlightenment is that we don't have to appeal to some supernatural being to make things happen, that we ourselves have the capability of making things happen. Okay? And so part of that resistance against myth and religion is a kind of a disdain for ritual, if you will. And then the last reason I find that people who come to the Zen Center, develop some kind of resistance to ritual is, let's say you come on Monday morning. We're closed this Monday, but you come in the morning and you're really interested in it. Why do you come? Well, you want to learn about your true self. You want to find the still point in you. Maybe you have some problems that you want to understand and dissolve. Maybe you want to transform yourself in some way. Okay? And so you have two periods of sitting. And at the end, people get up, and the next thing you know, they're bobbing up and down in prostrations. And of course, you want to be a good participant. So by the time they bob down, by the time you bob down, they're standing up again. They bob down, you stand up. Very awkward. You feel really awkward. And the other thing is, and the reason I wore my rakusu is that they're in groups and out groups. You look around and there are people with robes, rakusus, people who seem to know what they're doing, right? And then there's the rest of us who don't have a clue, right? And so we feel very awkward. And you figure, well, why should I come again? I came to transform my mind. I came to find the still point. All of these kinds of things. And here I am. I'm feeling even worse. I'm feeling awkward, I'm feeling out of place, etc. So all of these reasons, and there are more. I'll just mention one real quickly. If you read the early Buddha, what the Buddha said, The Buddhists talking against ritual too, because Buddhism is created within an Indian context of Brahmanism, which is highly ritualistic. And so he's saying, well, that's not the way we want to go, even though they're practicing rituals. Okay. Now, having said all of that, if you look at the front of the brochure, I say, quoting somebody, that the Zen life is overwhelmingly a life of ritual. So what's going on? You know, what's the method in the madness, if you will? You know what I mean? Why should we bow? What's all that about? And so I want to give some simple examples. I'm going to concentrate on bowing to make it, a little more digestible. This is the first of four talks I'm going to give on ritual, because I think our practice can truly deepen when we understand. Many people, for example, today, our members are going through something called Jukai, and they're sowing these things, and they're becoming Buddhists. But do they understand what all of that is about, what every part is about? So those are, and my feeling is, once you understand it, really deepens your practice. Okay, so just a little bit about about ritual and what we do. For me, ritual has both a content and a form. And it's important to distinguish between the two. The content means that when you do a certain vow in a certain place, it means something in that context. The form just is what unites all of these kinds of ritual, if you will. And so if you come in the morning, the first thing you do is you walk in the door and you bow towards the temple in Gassho. Now, one thing we should be aware of is that the Zendon, this place where we meditate, is really a mandala. A mandala is a sacred space. And if you look at the sacred space, you'll see it has symmetry. They're concerned that the mats are in front of the altar and things like this. In real advanced Buddhist practice, the idea is that everyone is a participant in this performance. If we can all become enlightened, you light the mandala up. And I don't think that's going to happen here anytime soon, but at least that's the idea. You come in and you bow, and you're not just bowing in Gassho, but you're looking at the altar. And what do you see in the altar? Well, we see flowers and we see candles and things like that. And in one sense, all of these are offerings to the Buddha. We offer candles, we offer flowers, etc. And that's important. But in another sense, they have other meanings. So we look at the flowers, and we bow at the flowers, and we recognize impermanence. We recognize attachment to the unchanging, because the flowers are beautiful today, and in a couple of days they're out, on the heap. And so we realize ourselves are changing. There's nothing permanent about it. We can't attach. We have to let go. Okay, we look at the candle, and we look at that light, and what do we see? We see wisdom and a prajna. Now, prajna or wisdom in Buddhism is not knowing all the answers to a quiz game like Jeopardy or something like that. Prajna is understanding the path and how to move along it. So that means understanding what your bowing is about. It means understanding what a prostration is about. It means understanding what the four parts of the Heart Sutra, which you chant every morning, is about. Things like this. And then we look in the middle. We have the flowers, impermanence. We have the candle, which is wisdom. In the middle, we have something called the Bodhisattva. This is a name, and I'll explain it in a minute. Our Bodhisattva has a name, Manjushri. And Manjushri usually has two swords. And as you sit and meditate and try to find the still point, Manjushri slices through your delusions, etc. And so Manjushri is kind of helping your practice. You might ask, what's a bodhisattva? What about this creature? Because some people say, well, I don't want to bow. I'm a Christian. I only bow to God. You know what I mean? But this isn't a god. Bodhisattvas are manifestations of our own emotions, our own mental abilities. And so bodhisattvas, basically, this is a bodhisattva of wisdom. Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva of compassion. We even have a bodhisattva-like individual Mara, who's the bodhisattva of deception. What better test on your way towards enlightenment to be tested and tested and tested? The Buddha's night of enlightenment, some of the very last tests was Mara came and tried to lure the Buddha away with his three lovely daughters and etc. So think of that bodhisattva there is a manifestation of your own mind. And so when you bow, basically, you're bowing to something in you, and you're hoping that that wisdom that's an inherent part of you, basically is going to help you in your practice. Then you move over to a cushion. You bow to your cushion. Well, what's that about? And you can figure, well, all this bowing stuff, what's that about? You know what I mean? Well, when you bow to your cushion, and you really bow to your cushion, etc., you're bowing and thanking everyone who ever sat on a cushion for the last 2,500 years. And if you do it with a full heart, it's really a lovely thing. Because not only do they sit there, but they led the way and they showed you what is possible. And Buddhism is very much a communal, ancestral kind of practice. So you're thanking all of those ancestors. And you do it heartfelt, not just bob your head. Though I must admit, some mornings you come in and it was a late night, and you're supposed to be doing all this in a heartfelt way, and all you're going to do is bob. If you can get that bob in there, that's all right. Then you turn around from your cushion, and you gassho out to the outer room. And what's that about? When you gassho to the outer room, you're thanking everyone there who's part of the mandala, etc., who's supporting your practice. And so if there are four or five other people, you're thanking them for being there. But also, you're recognizing that they are you. There is no difference, that you're all one. When you start, if you're not sure and you can't remember, as you bow out, you say, not two, not two, not two. There's only one. And that the idea of not to is going to play an important part in all of this. Well, that's the content, basically, of just a few simple rituals. And, of course, there are many others. But what about the form? And we usually say in Zen that any ritual, basically, is serving four purposes, in a general sense. One is you're expressing gratitude. You're thanking all of the bodhisattvas, all of the Buddhas, everyone, basically for bringing the practice. Secondly, you're expressing respect because the Buddhist achievement was a magnificent achievement. The fact that the Buddha managed to become a Buddha, it's more than enlightenment. If you're a bodhisattva, you move beyond nirvana. You adopt the practice of helping all beings. This is an amazing accomplishment, so you're showing respect. Thirdly, you're showing humility. That is, you're taking your ego and you're submitting your ego, basically, to this idea of oneness. You surrender, in a sense, to the oneness of all beings. In Japan, in many spiritual centers, as you enter the center, there's a gate, and the upper part of the gate is pretty low, so you have to bow your head, okay, reminding you you're submitting yourself, you're surrendering almost. In a full body prostration, which we do in the morning, where you actually get down and put your forehead on the ground, etc., is a wondrous thing because it's a full surrender. But again, you're not surrendering to some deity or being or something like that. You are immersing yourself into oneness, the everything. And so, if you understand that, it's great. And then the last of the four purposes is just that, an expression of oneness, that we are one with everything. Now, bowing, I said, is an action. And when you bow and do ritual in general, this is a visceral. This is a visceral performance. And they actually use the word performance. This is not something cognitive. This is something that's body, heart, and mind. You know what I mean? And you're not training in learning the bow. You're not training the cortical areas of your brain, if I can talk about those things, but you're training the limbic areas of the brain. You know what I mean? The hardwired areas of your brain, etc. And repetitive, 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 and repetitive. And when you do these rituals, you might, before you do the rituals, you want to understand it, but when you do them, you're not thinking cognitively. You're just doing it. You know, when you we'll get to you know, the Heart Sutra and some of these things in a minute. If this sounds strange, you know, you think, well, what's this stuff about training the limbic system and stuff like that? It sounds you know, pretty wild. It's no different than sports psychology. No different at all. And I used to run lots of marathons, and rather than huffing and puffing, which I usually did when I ran around Lake Calhoun, I would say, flow like the wind. If you can imagine, flow like the wind. But after a while, you'll have days when you flow around that lake. I didn't like to run up hills, you know, but you'd say, hills make me stronger. And so you run up and you just think that way. Also, you visualize yourself, basically, you know, running with the front of the pack. Running with the front of the pack. And if you watch athletes like tennis players or golfers who are using these kind of techniques, etc., that you see them without a racket or without a club, you know, practicing thousands of times in their mind what the swing looks like. And we're doing basically the same thing. It's a performative function. We don't think. We just do it and do it and do it and do it. Okay? And so again, not unlike. Now, the purpose of it all is to become one with the motion, and you know, that is that you know, you're just one with your motion. And what I mean by that is, you know, what we're trying to do in these actions is collapse subject and object, inner and outer, I and you, we and them. Yesterday and tomorrow, okay, here and there. And basically, when you collapse, if you can follow me, when your mind collapses into just being one with that motion, etc., you know, this is what basically Nibbana is about. Dogen Zenji, who was the founder of our particular lineage in Japan, said that when he experienced enlightenment, he experienced a dropping away of body and mind. A dropping away of body and mind. In other words, he just became one with basically what was there. And this is truly, when you reach that point, the world changes. There is no observer. And if there is no observer, there's no time. There is no space, right? There's no yesterday. There's no tomorrow. And so if somebody asks you, what was your original face before the Big Bang, you say, nothing but this lectern. What else could it be? What else could it be? What else could it be? If somebody asks you, these are these kind of koans, why did Bodhidharma come from the West? And you can say, he was always here. He was always here. Because there's no there. And there's no here. And so this is that kind of understanding once you reach, you know, once you empty into emptiness is what we call it, if you will. Now, talking about this kind of visceral training, it's hard for some people in the West, and I'm going to get a little more academic here, if I can. Basically, you know, during the Enlightenment, you know, we thought, kajigo ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And so we privileged cognition, we privileged training the mind, and now we're in a post-Cartesian age where we realize that that was a misstep, that we train the body, heart, and mind. We train the body, heart, and mind. And so a lot of the early books that concentrate fully upon the mind kind of miss what's going on. In this age-old Zen training, if you will. So this is where the sound of one hand clapping comes in, because I put that in the title someplace. And what is the sound of one hand clapping? And it sounds, what could that possibly mean? But once you see the two hands as nothing other than the dichotomy of subject and object, and nothing other than inner or outer, nothing other than I and you, and all of that collapses, there can only be one hand. And that understanding goes reverberating throughout eternity, etc. It's a truly great understanding. And again, there can only be one hand clapping if we collapse those metaphors, if you will. Now, none of this is easy. And there's a rhetoric that you run into in Zen that I refer to as microwave Zen. The idea is you put the popcorn in the microwave and boop, just like that. Somebody says, sit in the mat, 30 minutes is all you need. And in reality, it's hard work. Because you're working on yourself, and you're doing this repetitively, and you have to do it regularly. I mean, you can't just say, well, once a month I'm going to come to the Zen Center and eat cookies or something like that, but rather you have to have this established practice. And so it's hard work, if you will. One way I like to think of it is in phases and stages, and of course, if you do a lot of Zen, they don't like step ladders then, but it very much fits into this idea of really working at it. It can take 15 or 20 years or more, and for many people, they never hear the clap of one hand. They never hear it. There are various stage levels. For example, Xuang Tsang had 5 stages. The Buddha, actually, during his enlightenment, I went through 8 stages of consciousness, etc. The one I usually use is what's called the 10 Oxfording pictures. And there's usually beautiful pictures with little poems. The very first step is somebody comes into the forest looking for the ox. And what is the ox but our own self, our own mind self, our heart mind? And we're trying to understand ourselves by looking for the ox, if you will. And so some of you, and you may wonder what you got yourself into, but some of you are there. You've walked into the forest for the first time. Now you're looking for the ox. And then the second phase is you see some tracks of the ox. And that means that you've started, let's say, a meditation practice. And you're sitting there and you actually have moments where you feel the still point. Some moments. And then eventually you see part of the ox. And then it goes on and on. You see the ox, you tame the ox, you ride the ox home. By the 8th picture, it's blank. Or there's some symbol that means nothingness or emptiness, etc. Like Dogen, you let body and mind drop away. Okay? Body and mind have dropped away. And you realize that search will necessary. Once you get there, you look and see how ordinary. And the Buddha expressed it as that, we use all this effort and all these things as a raft to carry us across. And once we get across, of course, we don't carry the raft with us, we let it go. Wittgenstein, if we have any Austrian philosophers here, and at the end of his Tractatus, which is a big thing, he says, if you understood what I said, then you know that there's no meaning in my words. I only use words to get us to a certain level of understanding. Throw them away. Okay? Throw them away. That's hard to kind of grasp for many of us, if you will. Now, can you understand what I'm saying? I often think that basically it depends where you are in the search for the ox. If you just come in, if you've seen the tracks, things like this, etc., that you don't come in and grasp everything. It takes a while. It takes some effort. Just a little word or two on some of the other rituals. For example, leading the Zendo. For me, one of the most important parts of our morning service is actually when we leave the Zendo. And when you leave today, we usually give a little bow. And there's usually somebody standing there. For me, what you do when you leave the Zendo as a ritual is that you're saying, everything I learned, all my effort today, sitting in the Zendo, I'm carrying with me. I'm carrying with me out into the world. So it's a commitment to be a bodhisattva yourself, to go out and actually help people. So that's important. Just a little bit about chanting. When you chant, the idea is not to think of the words, but to intone the words. And they say you chant from your hara, which is the very part of your lower stomach. And you let that chant reverberate up through your head so it comes out. And if you read any of the literature on neuroscience, they say that actually zazen and chanting, etc., changes the architecture of your brain. And some people actually say we should chant not in English, but in Japanese or some other thing, so we are not distracted by the words, that we're just concentrating upon the tones as they reverberate throughout our body. And so if you come to some of our services, you see people rushing through the chant. Instead of, this, if you listen to tapes of chants from Japanese temples, it's avalokati, you're letting those sounds reverberate through your body, etc. And so this is a ritual of chanting. And then zazen itself, which is sitting meditation, is what's called, Dogen and all other great Zen masters say zazen, or sitting in a zendo, is not meditation. If we think of meditation as working with the mind. Now, you're not working with the mind or working to change anything. But what you're doing is you're doing a ritual enactment of being a Buddha. You think you're a Buddha, and you're sitting there as a Buddha. And this is why in the San Francisco Zen Center and places like that, people are so concerned about your posture. They come up and, they say, sit like a mountain, and you think you're sitting like a mountain, and somebody comes up and moves your shoulder and things like this. Because it's not the mind, it's the enactment of being a Buddha, if you will. And that's what you're doing, just being a Buddha. And if you believe you're a Buddha, you become a Buddha. That's basically the idea. Now, when you listen to me, you might think, well, this sounds awful traditional. This is a traditional guy. So I want to say a little bit about the difference between tradition and contemporary Zen. Oftentimes you hear people say to be traditional is to just follow basically all of the Japanese rituals, etc. To be contemporary is to get rid of them, okay, and do something else. I find that view very useful at all. To me, being traditional means that you are following, the traditions, but you're doing it because your teacher did it. And you think, there's this long tradition, and it's hubris, to think that I am going to come along and change all this after thousands of years. You know what I mean? But it fits very much into the me generation. We are the narcissistic society. We think we can change everything, etc. And I remember going to retreat, watching the priest, during a service, and he was moving things on the altar. So afterwards I said, well, why are you moving those things in the altar? He wanted to know. And he says, oh, I don't know. He said, my teacher did it. There's a real commitment to doing what's traditional so that you can pass it on to your students. And that's the way the thought. I'm a contemporary in the sense that rather than throwing tradition out, I think we should understand what it's about. What about the performative aspects? How does it change the brain, etc.? How can we modify those practices to fit into Western cultural historical situations? That to me makes more sense. And we're in the process at our Zen Center of trying to understand, well, how can we modify some of our ritual? Because even though a priest might be here every morning, what do you do with people who kind of wander in and don't quite understand it? What I'm talking about and where I'm heading with all this basically is to think in that contemporary sense. We don't want to throw the baby out with the water, as they say. We want to take those value performative, visceral aspects of Zen practice and really hold on to them. Let me close by just saying a little bit about some things we can do outside, the Zendo. Because some people think, well, I've come and I've practiced, and now I'm off to the coffee house, etc., and, a wild day and things like this. You can do things, and these are, you read about these things. You can, when you brush your teeth, you can do it in a very mindful way. And you can just focus on brushing your teeth. When you wash your dishes, every dish becomes the universe. Every dish becomes the Buddha. Every dish becomes the Dharmakaya, and all of those just mean eternity, oneness. You know what I mean? When we use the word Buddha, we usually mean oneness, or spirit, or whatever you want to call it. You can walk in a slow meditative way, not in the sense that you're going to get arrested when you go around Lake Yellow, but you're just attentive and walking along and being mindful. And those are just a few examples. Some of you, and if drinking tea is another one, some of you, for example, might want to construct a little home altar, in some little corner of the house where you have a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, you have flowers and a candle. Many altars, like the one in the Bruce has a bowl of water which symbolizes emptiness, for example, you can have a little performance yourself, even if it's 5 minutes every day. Well, that's it. I'm not going to give a reading, my intent was, to give you some, this is just a tip of the iceberg of what Zendo is and its place in Zen practice. I'm going to give some other Dharma talks on this. Thank you very much. If there are any questions or comments, I'm open. Kind of used to this, and so I said, "Yes, what's your question?" Mm-hmm. How could I find out more about ritual? Norman Fisher, Norman Fisher, who is a past abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, has a wonderful 3.5-hour series of talks that you can download on ritual, and says much of the same things I'm talking about, if you will. There's a book called, which I don't necessarily recommend, called Zen Ritual. But it's written by academics. Norman Fisher, a practitioner, actually has a very nice review of that book, in which he puts all of that into perspective. There's some other, there's a famous Zen teacher, James Ishmael Ford, Sensei, who has a very nice Dharma talk and ritual, etc. So I'm not inventing this. I'm kind of borrowing it and repackaging it, if you will.
I think I'm going to start spreading your story so that in 3 years there'll be stories about you floating on lotus flowers over people. So back at you for it's interesting to kind of going to different Buddhist centers to see that in Zen, the whole idea is just sitting, but it's one of the ritualistic practices in the days. It's a lot more bowing and Zen and a lot of types of Buddhism. But I love your talk. I think it's on a lot of different things. I think for me it was early on to have a lot of ritual because it's kind of the candy, enticed me in and having the view of the lake sort of thing, and then after a while, as my practice is deepened, I see more of it. It does different things. Also, I also think that I'm less on the path to enlightenment. Enlightenment way is just using meditation to guide my life a little bit more and deal with really suffering.
Absolutely. And all of the great Zen masters say that you don't in zazen to become enlightened. You're enacting the Buddha. That's it. Don't expect anything. That doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. It's not part, basically, of what you... Well, let me answer one other question. Thank you. because we don't talk about this too much, but in the various phases of training of a Buddha. And I wanted to mention that because we talk much about it. And as far as I'm concerned, there are three phases on the step to becoming a Buddha. And the first one is the step to nirvana, which is emptiness. And so that's what we've been basically talking about here. You hear that one and you laugh, etc. And then the second phase, you experience emptiness. Emptiness is not looking in the box with nothing in it, right? It's this booming, buzzing, dynamic world, but it's all one. And you can be a not with a K and spend years studying emptiness. And this is what Arhat does. If you know an Arhat, is a certain kind of Buddha. They become entrapped on emptiness. They don't know how to get out of it. Third phase is becoming a bodhisattva. Leave the world of emptiness and re-enter the world. To re-enter the world as a bodhisattva, the people, realizing this is some, realizing there's no one to save. There's no message. There's no one to save somebody because it's all empty, right? So how do you do that? And Dogen said all of this in a little phrase. Said when I first started in Buddhism, Zen mountains. That is, he hadn't reached the phase of emptiness. And after I had studied for a while, mountains were no longer mountains. You got rid of words. What do words do? Put boundaries around things and give them names like mountains. And when there's just that there. And then he said, after I studied more, mountains were just mountains again. So that is, he had re-entered the world. And so we have a long way to go. And I think I'll stop there. Thank you. Thank you all.